It's a time-honored rule, one that has kept many a family gathering from devolving into a shouting match. No politics at the dinner table, please. But after a presidential election unlike any other in American history, will the old rules still apply to your Thanksgiving dinner? And is it even healthy to always avoid conflict with the ones we love? This hour, we swap stories of family strife, vent some feelings, and get advice on how to disagree after an election that exposed deep divisions in our nation and our homes. The advice will come courtesy of a panel that's in the studio with me. Kevin Carr is a licensed professional counselor. Kevin, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you.
And we also have Karen McClintock. She's a licensed psychologist in private practice and a preacher, a leader in the spiritual community here. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thank you for welcoming me.
And we have Cody Christofferson. He's a clinical psychologist on the faculty at Southern Oregon University. Welcome, Cody.
Good morning, Emily.
So just to stress, there's lots of room for people at our table this hour. In fact, some already weighed in over the exchange's voicemail and on social media. Lisa in Curry County's one. She says, we never talk about politics in our home, ever. Lisa in Redding seconds that. She says, simple fix, just don't talk about politics. Karen, let's start with you. What are your thoughts on using avoidance as a strategy for dealing with conflict in our close relationships?
What we don't talk about often defines who we are.
How do you mean?
Well, I want to start by who talks and who doesn't talk, because I think even when we say we don't talk about certain things, the conversation is still going to be directed by people depending on certain hierarchies of privilege. So people at the table may talk or not talk depending on things like class, status, race, ethnicity. So we end up with these tricky sorts of rules in the family about who gets to talk as well as what we can talk about.
Cody, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think thinking generally about family dynamics and conflict, avoidance would be a less optimal strategy. But thinking specifically about a once-a-year event, I can see how this would make sense for a family to adopt temporarily to say, hey, the purpose of us getting together is not let's get to the bottom of this Measure 97 thing. Let's get to the bottom of this Donald Trump thing. It's let's appreciate each other and enjoy one meal of the year together.
Uh-huh.
And so in that sense, I would say that avoidance could be a reasonable coping strategy for a family to take for one night.
For one night. And what about in the longer run, though? Kevin Carr, do you have a thought on that?
In the longer run, you mean not at Thanksgiving?
Not at Thanksgiving, yeah. But Thanksgiving, of course, for me, I think things tend to come to a head around Thanksgiving. You've got all this stress. You're making this big meal. And maybe they are people that you only see once a year, but maybe they're not. Maybe they're your friends or your family. But spending all that time together preparing something kind of intense like a feast brings things to the surface.
Yeah, I think it's different for different people. I had an experience the day after the election on an airplane sitting next to a supporter of the opposite camp, and we spent our time listening to each other.
Really?
It was incredibly healing for me.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it always, as always, it depends on the personalities involved. There's strategies for dealing, I think, with people who you know you might have conflict with. So I don't know that there's one answer to that. I had another friend who told me the other day that she had a screaming argument with a good friend till 5 a.m. in the morning. And I said, well, that must have been horrible. And she said, well, it was, but I think it was cathartic for both of us. So, you know, it's hard to this way, but I think there are strategies to deal with it. And some of it is what do we want to have happen here? Who do I want to be at Thanksgiving? You know, who do I want my family to be? Is that realistic? Just, I think maybe putting some thought into beforehand.
Right. And I mean, we did have some people weigh in advance, and maybe you have your own questions for our panel here of mental health professionals or something from your own life to share, whether you're avoiding politics altogether because it's Thanksgiving, or maybe we're going to use this as an opportunity to try to have that listening conversation and get to a more meaningful place with someone you disagree with and that you love. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, or jx@jeffnet.org to send your email with your thoughts. Some of these thoughts did arrive via voicemail earlier this week. Deva in McKinleyville says the election drove a wedge between her and her brother.
Hi. I am definitely not someone who supports what Donald Trump represents and my brother, who I'm really close with, did vote for Donald Trump and is really hopeful that he can fix some of the problems in our country. And I don't call it arguing. We just talk really loudly to each other over the phone for way longer than we intended. But he just flew up, and we're going to have Thanksgiving and go to a Thanksgiving gathering where there are going to be people with diverse views. And I think that it's really important for people to keep the conversations going, talk, right? Even argue, talk in loud voices, but realize that in the end, they are your family. I'm your family, and love is the bottom line. So we're working towards understanding and keeping that discussion open. But in the end, it's like, okay, now let's go to the beach. Okay, now let's eat. I love you. You're my family. So I hope that people can somehow not lose sight of that, even though we disagree. Thanks. Bye.
So some advice there to both engage with people and then let it go from Deva in McKinleyville. I got to say, though, some people are better at disagreeing than others. Karen, you started off mentioning how there are these hierarchies in our family about who gets to talk and when and about what. What are some strategies that work well when you want to have a disagreement or you want to actually be able to express yourself and have a meaningful conversation, not just avoid the topic?
I have a magic sentence, which is, I can understand how you might feel that way.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not agreeing, but I'm saying, in light of who I know you to be, I can understand your feelings. And that's what we call a bridge statement. So there are some ways in which we can use bridge statements to really literally cross that emotional chasm when we're talking about difficult subjects.
And Cody, do you think of any pitfalls? I mean, Karen saying using these I statements or just acknowledging that someone's feelings are real, whether or not you agree with them, feelings are real, they have impacts. What are some pitfalls, some things sort of not to do when you're disagreeing with someone?
Well, I think I completely agree with Karen. And I think that something that happens in therapy sometimes is that in any relationship, in a couple or in a family, as a therapist, observe almost no listening has been going on for a very long time, actually. And so people have been talking to each other and responding to one another, but almost no listening. And by listening, I mean actively attempting to understand the other person's point of view, which could end up in a statement like, I understand how you could feel that way or think that way. And so this a pitfall would be then to try to win or try to forcefully get your point across. That's not helpful in a relationship, and it's not helpful for individual feelings, even if you feel good about having, quote, won the debate temporarily. It doesn't heal the relationship.
I could see those. How would people know? I mean, if you're looking at a couple or a relationship and you're saying there's no listening going on, but the people in that relationship might not realize that because they hear the other person. They can probably predict what the other person is going to say or how they're going to react. How can we kind of check ourselves to know if we're not really listening?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one hint is if the conversation continues to go in a circle over and over again, you seem to make the same points and counterpoints, you have the same debates over and over again. At that moment, if that's happening, stop. Try to rephrase in your own words what the other person is saying and check out with them to see, am I understanding what you're saying here? Then get to the feeling behind the words and see if you're accurately understanding their feelings. I think that's a way out of that loop.
We can also get in a habit of formulating our response while the other person is talking.
Yeah, in talk radio, we know a little bit about that, right? You get afraid of silence or something. Like, you can't just let it sit in for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Carr, you use a lot of talking and listening in your approach to counseling. I saw that you're a proponent of something called narrative therapy. Could you tell us how telling stories and listening to other people's stories can help us resolve our conflicts?
It's a huge subject, but basically everything we're talking about is a narrative that is going on in your own brain. We're talking about your listening, but at the same time you're formulating your narrative.
Mm-hmm.
it's also we define ourselves by the stories we tell and the stories others tell us about us. So, what Karen was saying about hierarchies, that's a narrative. That's a story. It's got a lot of power because a lot of people believe in it. But so the way I use it when what Cody was saying, I'll talk to a couple, for instance, about the pattern that they're in. And do they know what the, as you said, what they do they know what the other person's going to say? And how long has this been going on? And then we'll talk about, and every time it comes up then in the session, I say, are we in the pattern again? And they'll say yes. Mm-hmm. By saying yes, they're a little bit out of the pattern. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I'll ask people about the narratives that are guiding their relationships. And then, how you know, when are you not in the narrative? And what are the characteristics? And we might come up with, well, I'm listening. What constitutes listening? What constitutes hearing the other person? How long has it been since you heard the other person? And oftentimes talking about feelings and getting to a place where I'm just sad or I'm miserable or I'm frightened or I'm terrified. And that's a good place, I think, around a Thanksgiving table to get to. What if a family could all say, well, I'm afraid, you know, or I'm happy. Mm-hmm. Why are you happy? Because we'll fix the things. Why did you want to fix them? Because I was afraid.
Oh, being vulnerable at the Thanksgiving table, it sounds like I'd feel more plucked than the bird, I think.
Well, especially if there's alcohol involved.
Yeah. Well, and sarcasm is something that comes up a lot, I think, when we don't know quite how to deal with each other or we're not ready to let those guards down and say, I feel sad or I understand what you're feeling, but instead we'll just sort of try to use humor and often misuse humor. I mean, it can be such a tonic when we're at each other's throats, but what about sarcasm in particular? I think that I have siblings and that's such a cornerstone of our dynamic. Karen, is it ever helpful to be sarcastic when you're dealing with conflict?
I was thinking that when I teach in the university setting and I talk about sarcasm in communication, a lot of pushback happens because there are lots of families that grow up with sarcasm as a main form of communication. From my view, it's veiled hostility. It's not generally helpful. And we've had so much inflammatory rhetoric these last few months, 6 months throughout the election cycle, that I think we're ready for the kind of conversations that my colleagues here are suggesting. And I would say, let's avoid sarcasm. And I would have people avoid why. Because why is like throw down the glove, get the swords out. So if you start a sentence with why, you're going to have a response that's defensive and no matter what you do. So I, in general, would avoid that sarcastic response. Glenn Beck yesterday went public saying he was apologizing for scaring children with his rhetoric. So we know that people can get very, very hurt by our rhetoric. So maybe a time to quiet and be ready for right speech at the table would be a good idea.
Leave the sarcasm at home or put it in the closet this Thanksgiving.
Of course, there are. There are families that manage to use sarcasm, and they all do it, and it's funny.
Yeah.
And they all agree it's funny.
And a little levity goes a long
way. And they make points. You know, they may have – I mean, I'm saying that in general, I think sarcasm is a deflection or not that. But there are a lot of families that do it to keep things light and to keep things floating and keep things safe. So – it's not totally black or white, I think.
Nothing usually is in this life.
Exactly.
We are – go ahead, Karen.
Sorry. There's such a fine line between humor and sarcasm.
Right.
So I want to be clear. I wouldn't rule out humor because humor is just so wonderfully healing.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But there is like you're right on the fence and it could go either way at either time. And not everyone feels safe to say ouch.
That's exactly true.
When the sarcasm goes toward the painful side.
And is that word that's a good way to just alert someone that they've crossed a line there? Just, ouch. You know, instead of immediately fighting back, which is, I think, my time-honored coping strategy as a kid was just to one-up the person that had just hurt me instead of saying, ouch, you just hurt me. So we want to hear about your family here on The Exchange. We're talking with Karen McClintock. She is a licensed psychologist and a preacher with a master's in divinity. We also have Kevin Carr with us. He's a licensed professional counselor. And Cody Christofferson, a clinical psychologist on the faculty at SOU. I'm Emily Curitan, and we hope you'll join this discussion. You can give us a call at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org with your own stories of getting along with your family, especially in the wake of such a divisive political climate, or in the midst of such a divisive political climate. Let's take a call now from Kyle in Arcata. Kyle, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, how's it going this morning? I want to thank your guests and everybody for showing up to talk about this today. It's definitely an important topic, considering what's been going on recently. And I think a lot of the points that they've made about having a civil discourse is super important. I kind of think of it, you know, I'm also in academia, and I think of it as, how would I have a discussion with my colleagues? And then I try to transfer that in with my family. And although often we feel a lot more comfortable with our families to maybe say more things than we would otherwise, or say it in a different way, I think still it's important to have that type of respect. At the same time, I think it is important to have this discourse and to not just shut off and not talk about politics or not do anything like this, because, you know, that's kind of how we got to the position where we are in the first place, with people not talking. So I think discourse, and especially civil discourse, is super important. So thank you guys again for having this discussion, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Kyle. That's an interesting point he makes about just treating people with respect. Sometimes it's hardest with the people we're closest to. Any thoughts on why that is?
Oh, I think, you know, we all get to go back to that term narrative, which I don't always use. You have a story about who you're with. It's not who you're with. And it takes time to actually see a person, or really see a person. And some of us don't make it in an entire lifetime. But it's incredibly good work. And I think it's built on trying to understand what pictures you are projecting onto your partner and try and move them away. Uh-huh. And this listening that we were talking about. I mean, listening is, that's the whole ball of wax. And listening to the other person, listening to yourself, you know, trying to calm down and see who's there, who's at the table.
Yeah, I think I agree. And I think before entering into the event that you're going to, or before meeting up with the people, it can be really helpful, along the lines of what the caller was talking about, to understand your own purpose for doing that, for going to the event, or for inviting the people you're inviting. If you're not conscious about it, if you're not willfully mindful of your own values and the purpose for which you're behaving, then you can end up fighting ancient battles across the Thanksgiving table, or attempting to resolve slights in the past, or perceived injustices. And you do it through veiled sharp comments, through sarcasm, through even politics itself can become the battleground for really a different sort of conflict, like between siblings or between parents. And so if you know that you're entering into a potentially conflict-filled meeting or evening or few days with a family, it can be helpful. You might even journal, or just consider, you know, what am I doing here and what am I trying to accomplish? And then throughout the time that you're with your family, you might ask yourself, is the behavior that I'm engaging in now moving me towards this value, this goal that I have, or not? And then I think that's one way to defang some of those conflicts.
Karen, you recently spent time with your own family before the election. And were you able to defang? How are you feeling in the wake of that experience?
Thank you. What I'm aware of is we have family in Georgia. And we spent some time back there before the election. And they not everyone in Georgia would be on any side of the political divide. But we have very different views on a number of issues. What the election has done, actually, since the election, is opened up our conversations. We have people in very different political sides of things. We also recognize that we're here on the West Coast, and they have a different viewpoint of where the country is and where their own experience is. We have family who have come through military service, been part of our great military service, and but it also leaves them with some things that are really kind of challenging for my husband and I here on the West Coast in terms of attitudes toward women, attitudes about the nature of the involvement of government in daily lives. So what it's meant is that we've been braver now about saying things like, not all men engage in locker talk. That's not a necessary part of male culture. Mm-hmm. So it's given us a chance to sort of open up some conversations that we were scared to be part of. Even when we were back there and we of course, just sort of naively believed we would get our righteous rewards in the end, and they would all suffer the consequences of the election, which, of course,
smug silence. Yeah.
Yes, it doesn't work for us now, at all. So what we're left with is to be humbled in our conversations and to say, again, as Cody so well stated, what is the common ground? What is the value? We believe in this nation. We believe in many things in common. We have hope for reconciliation with all of our neighbors. We have hope for, in our side of things, a multicultural America of respect and kindness. So we keep going back to, I love your list idea, you know, I probably want to do that, put down that list of what it is I value that I could speak to.
And also your goal for the event, you know, what am I trying to change the hearts and minds of people that I have known all my life and have not changed up until this point, or am I trying to appreciate them as they are and how they are. Karen, your comments just now made me want to bring in some that we got from a person who didn't give their name, but they live here in the Rogue Valley and took our online survey on our Facebook page, also up at jeffexchange.org. They said they do strongly disagree with family members and they'll be spending time with them tomorrow. Their strategy, quote, avoid, 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 especially at dinner. The issues are too deep. I'm of mixed race, but aren't we all? And I have a parent who in the past, at least, has been open in their racist comments without remorse. It's terribly awkward. So that's coming out of the Rogue Valley. Maureen in Curry County commented on our Facebook post. She said racism and sexism are, quote, not policy differences to discuss at the dinner table. I have no problem with a family member who decides to take a pass on Thanksgiving with their Trump-supporting family members. I would view it as nonviolent protest. So yet another person took our survey and they said, simply, if someone in my family voted for Trump, they're not invited to Thanksgiving. We're about to take a break here, but I want to unpack some of that on the other side. People are really staking out their camps. There's talk about which side of history you're on right now, and we're trying to zoom it back into which side of the table you're on for Thanksgiving with family members that you may or may not agree with. I'm Emily Curitan. This is the Jefferson Exchange, and we're going to address those listener comments on the other side of about a minute and a half break here. Stick with us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, it's 8:36, and I'm Emily Curitan. We're talking about family dynamics and conflict this hour, just in time for Thanksgiving. Whether you were with her or you voted for Donald Trump, if politics drove a wedge in your family or your friend group, let's hear from you now. Did you vote? Did your vote become a family feud, or have you figured out a way to deal with that or not deal with it? Give us a call, 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. I'm here with Kevin Carr, Dr. Karen McClintock, and Dr. Cody Christofferson, our panel of mental health professionals. I feel much calmer just being in the room with you guys. We left off a conflict here from the Rogue Valley about, you know, a dad in a mixed race family who will say racist things about other people. And kind of how do you deal with that other than just checking out, or is that some of these issues that, like you were saying, Karen, it's opened up a dialogue on points where things are not okay. It's not okay to talk about women's bodies like they're, you know, objects to be handled. It's not okay to say these things. We've seen a lot of lines drawn in this election. How can we stand up for what we believe in with our family members and still continue relationships that, you know, they're unconditional by their very definition?
You know, one thing's hitting me, is we have to make clear, is that most of the people I know who voted for Trump do not think he's a racist. Mm-hmm. And they do not think they are racists. And some of the arguments that ensue are, yes, you are, no, you're not. Mm-hmm. Here's the evidence that you are, and that kind of thing. I think that's a different class of interaction than with someone who is actively espousing and admitting that they are a racist and making racist comments. And then I think some of the suggestions we made is that's not okay. That hurts.
Karen, you have thoughts there?
I'm going back to ouch.
Ouch.
And I'm really uncomfortable with this conversation. And I need to take a walk. and calm myself down, and I'll come back to the table. There are some self-care strategies. Maybe I need an ally sitting next to me. Maybe I need to shorten the time I stay. Those would be self-care strategies in the middle of that. I tell people often in workplaces, you can always go to the bathroom and stay a while. No one's going to ask you why you're there.
I've heard some funny ones there. Take the dog out for a walk, or mm-hmm. the opposite. Sit down at the table, ask everyone who they voted for, and then just wait for the food to be deserted, and then you get it all to yourself.
There you go.
Yeah.
I actually like the idea of seeing if the table group would be willing to invite the children to speak first. Hmm. Or the autistic 15-year-old, or grandma who's 92, that there might be some ways we could invite storytelling, as mm-hmm. you were suggesting, so that we would say, bring to the table a funny story of a family trip that went haywire. Mm-hmm. Bring to the table that dog you loved. You know, what happened to that dog you love? But pick the good stories, not the tragic stories. So there might be some ways that you could begin even that table grouping in a way that wouldn't start with those, let me tell you who you are.
Oh, let me tell you what. That's a really common turn of phrase that we joke around with in my family.
With regard to the person who wrote in and described a specific situation where the parent is making racist comments mm-hmm. or comments that are perceived as racist and that are hurtful to the person. I think it might be helpful in a situation like that to lay some groundwork for a get-together and to assume good faith until you know for sure otherwise. And what I mean by that is this person might directly address with their parent, when you make comments about X group, I feel hurt and I try to be heard in that sense. Because I think if you assume good faith, you assume that this is my parent. My assumption is not that they're trying to wound me, and to let the person respond before you get to the big event, right? Before you get to the Thanksgiving dinner. You can show up for yourself in that way also at the Thanksgiving dinner. But I think if you know that there's a persistent pattern, this person is always talking about this group and it really hurts my feelings because I feel like I'm part of that group or I'm an ally to that group, then why not assume good faith, bring your feelings to that person and see if they can respond in an empathic way. If they can't, or if, you know, your assumption of good faith is violated and it's like this person's going to say what they're going to say and they don't care who it hurts, then these other coping mechanisms or these other approaches, like I think I'm going to skip Thanksgiving this year, I think that makes more sense. But if you value having a relationship with this person, it can make sense to approach them in a good faith effort.
So try to elicit empathy first by mm-hmm. instead of attacking back and saying, hey, that's racist, you're a racist, saying, when you say that, it hurts my feelings.
Absolutely.
I'm kind of at a lot. It's hard not to immediately go to that point of just loading up your, pulling one out of your mm-hmm. quiver and letting it go there. Because when you feel like they're attacking, yeah. It does immediately trigger that response.
Part of it, I think, is again, planning. Who am I going to be at this dinner? Who do I want to be? What's my best self? What's my worst self? What's my most reactive self? What's it feel like to be that way? And how can I catch myself if I start to get into that mode, if my chest tightens and my fists clench and I start to feel the blood pounding at my temples? That might be the time to get up and take a walk, whether anything is said or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then have a strategy of, well, I'm going to listen and see if there's another way, a way that I haven't responded before. Because probably I've responded this way if I'm worried about a conflict, probably I've taken up my cudgel many times before. And how can I not? How can I do it differently in a way that I'm not just sitting there getting bashed?
It's mm-hmm. lovely.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kevin Carr, Karen McClintock, and Cody Christofferson about how to get along with your family over the holiday, and in general, how do you reckon the disagreements born out of an incredibly divisive political season and presidential election? We hope you'll join this discussion. We have a few minutes left here, and your stories are more than welcome. 800-838-3760 to give us a call, or our inbox, always open to you, at jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a question from Abram in Ashland. Abram says he does not strongly disagree with family members about politics, but he did want to ask the panel, have you ever encountered a family that truly lived in harmony? And if so, to what would you attribute their success?
I think that term harmony is key, because harmony is not everybody the same, right? That's just melody. That's just one line, all the same notes. Harmony means difference that comes together in a beautiful way. And do such families exist? Sometimes, yes. Every family can be that way. No family exists that way in perpetuity. It takes work to do that. And I think that acknowledging there's difference here is the start to the path to harmony.
You know, that old saying that every happy family is alike, or it's actually the first line of War and Peace or Anna Karenina. I can't remember which one. Yeah. But every happy family is alike, and every unhappy family unhappy in their own way, which is why starting to unravel the threads here of disharmony. As you said earlier, Kevin, nothing is black and white. Karen, do you want to weigh in on that? What creates a harmonious family? Have you ever met one, for one thing?
Well, we work in therapy to foster those kinds of relationships. So I have the gift of watching people move from defense and attack to securely attached relationships where, okay, we can be different, but we can still be close. And that's what we're aiming for. You know, we can still really love each other in the midst of it. I brought W.H. Auden's great poem after the holidays. He writes, "We have once again attempted quite unsuccessfully to love all of our relatives and in general, grossly overestimated our power."
That's funny. Paula and Ashlyn, actually, she shared a quotation of hers, a favorite for her mind going into Thanksgiving, and it's from Ram Dass. She says, "If you think you're enlightened, go home for Thanksgiving." So these experiences, you know, the ones that humble us, I find there's great power in being humbled. Although, Kevin, you were describing the physical sensation of being challenged by a family member at the dinner table when your blood starts to pound and you flush, and the idea of who am I? Who do I want to be in this situation? There's such a gulf between those two things so often, because you become like a version of your younger self, or maybe someone that you don't actually want to be, or that you aren't when you're not around these people.
Yeah, I think there's two sides to that, too. There's who I want to be, and there's who I'm imagining the other person is. There's a trick that sometimes works. It's a visualization thing, especially if I'm catching myself anticipating reacting in an age-old, conflictual way with some loved family member, is to sit there and let myself feel that anger and feel that. And then, if I can, simultaneously think about a time when we were very close, or we had a close exchange, or I felt loved by that person, and hold both those things simultaneously. And if I can, then there's a very slight possibility, actually more than slight, possibility of being able to say, how do I want to be? How do I want to react? And it sometimes helps you to be a little less reactive. Mm-hmm. If you can, and it's hard to hold both things, but it's possible.
Take a beat and think about a place that was better.
And both things at the same time. I'm feeling this, but I'm also feeling this.
Hmm. Let's go to a call here. We've got Jim in Grants Pass on the line. Hi, Jim. Welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, good morning. Kind of answer to that question you had. There's two things. Who at a group do you feel you can trust and rely on to be there to straighten out any problems? Too many things are love and believe in and faith in and all those kind of shallow things. But when some deep ripples, you know, hit the pond, you want to trust and rely on to straighten things out are the biggies.
All right, Jim, thanks for that comment. Responses from our panel here?
Yeah, I think it's always good to know who are your allies if your family has divides. And
what if you don't have any allies? What if you're just totally outnumbered?
McDonald's for lunch.
McDonald's for lunch. On that point, I want to go to Dennis and Eugene. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Yeah, say, I'm 70 years old. Everybody in my family is a racist. And everybody in my wife's family is a racist. And we are not. We are basically considered a pariah by our family because we don't adhere to their Christian rules and their biased, bigoted, hateful speech. And the way I deal with it is I just don't have anything to do with them because I wouldn't have anything to do with anybody else like that.
Dennis, do you have a question? I mean, does it hurt you to be separated from these people?
What do they think? Just not deal with them.
All right. Dennis and Eugene there.
Yeah, I think that's a toughie. And it's especially hard if that's your feeling, but your wife maybe wants to be more connected to the family. And I've seen that as a struggle that takes a lot of negotiation, I think, and a lot of tender care. And sometimes the agreement that one goes to a Thanksgiving and one doesn't, and sometimes they alternate, and sometimes they focus on the caring. You know, the caller before talked about an ally, you know, that your loved one, your wife, your husband is your ally in this, and that you work on what's going to be the best for the both of you.
Right, so Dennis there would have a built-in ally in his wife, but I guess he's saying, at that point, people do make that choice in their lives. I said earlier that family bonds are unconditional, but they're not. I mean, people don't necessarily deserve to be in our lives if we reach a point that we don't want them there anymore. But I think we're talking...
There's one more point I could make, which I think is the narrative that you can say to yourself, which is, I might love those people. I can't have that kind of attitude in my life. I can't have that belief system because I find it destructive. So that allows me to separate out that I can care about those people. I might be sad when they die. I might have had a good reaction with or a good relationship, a good moment with one or the other of them. But the overall attitude they're taking, I can't have. And separate the person from that attitude. Because people sometimes, not always, but sometimes can let go of some of those things. Uh-huh. But you can say, that's like poison gas for me, and I'm not going to walk in that room.
And I think what I'm hearing in the caller's comment is actually no conflict. The caller is resolved. This is my value and this is how I'm going to live. And sort of asking, is this okay? I think, yes, that's fine to live your life with no conflict in this way. It's your life to live. I think most of us find ourselves more along the lines of what Kevin has described as needing to hold complex truths that seem to conflict at times. And how can we become more nuanced in our view of others because we value being with them and yet some of their opinions or views we strongly disagree with. But if you don't value those relationships anymore or you've attempted a good faith reconciling and haven't been able to do that, then, you only have one life and, follow your values in that sense is my suggestion.
Well, I remembered sitting with a couple in my office, and they were doing attack strategies. And I remember saying, do you want to be right or do you want to be close? And the answer that came back was both.
Right. And you can't have both necessarily.
Not always.
Yeah. Karen, you've done work reconciling people with some extremely deep divisions, some extreme wrongs done within families and trying to heal those bonds. Could you talk a little bit more about how we come out of an environment where we're shaming people or blaming them for, say, the outcome of a presidential election? You know, what's the antidote to those sorts of feelings?
I'm stuck on the labeling problem. I think anytime we go to label someone, we get into trouble. So we might say, my family holds racist attitudes, and you were just doing this so naturally a minute ago, Glenn, then that separates the person from the label. So anytime we engage in shaming and blaming, we can't get very far. And often the blame is our own internal shame. That's a terrible feeling. You don't want to feel shame. So you flip it over to the other side of it, and you go to a place of blaming. So I can blame you for what I don't want to own inside of me. And that's some of this dynamic that gets very complex. And we would love it if we had I'd love it if I had one of either of my co-guests here at my table, and you could help us sort that through. Because there's what you say, and then there's these bubbles over your head, which is what you're really feeling or what you're really meaning. And I think that we're saying stay as conscious as possible of what that bubble is over your head so you can affirm yourself and hold on to yourself in the middle of really highly conflicted conflicts or conversations.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Karen McClintock. She's part of our panel here. She's a licensed psychologist. Cody Christofferson, he's a clinical psychologist, also with us. And Kevin Carr is a counselor. You can join this discussion, a few minutes left here on the Jefferson Exchange, to vent about your family conflict and maybe get some productive advice. 800-838-3760 is the phone number, or jx@jeffnet.org. We got a comment here from Kay Lynn in Ashland. She's also a mental health professional. Kaylin wrote to us, don't underestimate the shock and pain that's out there. It's unfortunate this holiday is occurring right now because I think a lot of people are just not ready to talk about it. If people do try to talk with family in the other camp, I would predict a lot of painful and unforgivable things that could be said. So I'd say give it a little time, perhaps in a month or two when it's not quite so raw. This is not just your normal over the Thanksgiving table difference of opinion. It's deep and it's still very, very raw. That from Kaylin and Ashlyn. So do you guys, does this feel different? You must deal with this every year, like a spike of really stressed out people around the holidays.
Yeah, but it's often, I'm not sure that it's always about conflict. Usually it's about depression. Mm. It's about people having dreams about the family they wish they'd had or the family they wish they did have. Or having had such bad experiences as young folks that they just can't stand the holidays and they hibernate, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, that brings me to an interesting reminder that this is a day about gratitude and about being thankful for what we have, even if it's not exactly what we would have dreamed of or the family that we would build for ourselves. It's what we've got, and a lot of people maybe don't have that benefit.
The family may also be the source of the wounding. So if you've come out and been rejected, if you had child sexual abuse that your family ignored, you've got a lot more going on at this holiday than the election divide. And so the other thing at holidays is loss. Who did you lose during this year that you're missing at the table? Who might not have been able to get there, who you're missing at the table? But we do see a spike. Even the APA put out a letter to all the psychologists in the nation saying they're seeing a spike in stress right now. Mm-hmm. So we have this double whammy of the election divides and all these issues we've named.
Let's take one more call here. We've got John in Medford on the line. Hi, John.
Hi. I think you're going to have to get these folks back to answer this question another day. But anyway, here it goes. I'm heading to Standing Rock Reservation beginning of December. So some suggestions for applying these strategies in that environment.
All right. And you mean with people that you're going to meet there, John?
No, I'm meaning, you know, there's obviously two sides to this argument at that location. So how about some strategies for how to apply these strategies in that environment?
All right, John. Thanks for that. Cody, you have thoughts?
Yeah, John, I don't know about your background, but in general, good advice for an outsider ally who's attempting to help any group that's oppressed or in trouble is to be a listener, to not take over as a spokesperson, to amplify the voices of the allied group that you're attempting to help, and to primarily listen and support. And so I think that could apply in the Standing Rock situation. That could apply also at your Thanksgiving dinner if you have a member of a family who you have a sense is oppressed or otherwise wounded. Try to listen to that person and amplify their voice rather than take over and be a spokesperson.
Yeah, and what one would hope in a larger conversation is that, which I haven't seen much, is that people who support the police side or the oil company side would have conversation with the people who are there protesting where they could listen. And if that could be mediated, that'd be fantastic. I don't know how to make that happen or if it's possible, but it's certainly a great goal.
Let's go out here. We've got Susan and Eugene on the line. And Susan, we just have a couple of seconds here. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, thank you for having me. I haven't heard anybody comment on the effect of alcohol during Thanksgiving dinners, which people tend to drink a lot, and my guess is that allows people to extend the bait and other people to take it pretty easily. And I think counseling people to drink less would be really supportive of better Thanksgiving dinners. Thanks.
Okay, Susan, that's about as succinct as we could ask for. So final thoughts on laying off the sauce this Thanksgiving?
Drink less.
Drink less. Yes.
That makes everybody more reactive.
Okay, good. That's our thoughts on resolving or at least navigating family conflict around the holiday season. I want to thank our guests, Karen McClintock, Dr. Karen McClintock. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
And Cody Christofferson, Assistant Professor of Psychology at SOU. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Kevin Carr, counselor. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.